Good morning. This is Tech Talk. I think we made it. We're going to try this. I think I see someone from Canada on the other line here. Do we got him? Oh, man. Well, how about try this? There we are. There we go.
Hello.
Now we got him. Dave, can you hear me, Dave?
No, I can't.
Somebody clicked off all of our pre's. That's why. Rob told me, he said, hey, make sure you check your pre. Nobody knows what I'm talking about. But on an audio board, there's this button. It's called pre. It's your preamp. And if it's not turned on, then nobody can hear you. The audio doesn't go through. So I think we got it, though. I think we got it. You can hear me. I'm happy about that.
I'm so glad you're not a pilot.
Oddly enough.
Good morning, everybody.
Rob is. So, yeah, good morning. Good morning. Oh, my gosh. You know what today is, Dave?
I don't.
It is the last day of the century that we have that will be sequential. It is 12, 13, 14. At least if you count your numbers in Western date format, as opposed to the European date format.
Of the century?
This is it. This is the only one. Yeah, because after this, we go up high enough in numbers that we can't have months that would add up. So it's 12 for December 13th, the 13th day. And at 10-11, we'll have to, I don't know, I need a bell or something. I mean, ding, 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 it'll be 10-11, 12, 13, 14.
Wow.
And this is
That's exciting.
This is the day. So for people that like to celebrate coincidences and numeric oddities, I guess this is a red letter day for you. Dave is underwhelmed.
Your
studio, watch us, not just listen. You can actually see what we're up to and what the things that are going on. It's part of our push and promotion that we're doing right now for the WRLR Radiothon. I know we talk occasionally about how. Oh, here we go. Here's Dave again. Let's bring him on. I know he's going to want to have some commentary. But I was just telling people about Radiothon. We're doing this new streaming video and things, and part of that is this promotion for the Radiothon. Oh, you there, Dave? Now, you know what? We are having lots of problems with the internet connection, and I can see it happening here again. We're getting real bad slowdown. I don't know if they're to keep Dave connecting here and see what we can do. When he does come on, though, as I said, I know he's going to be interested at least in hearing or finding out about the Radiothon. So the deal with the Radiothon is that personalities, everyone at the radio here is kind of coming together in order to be on air live and local. We're always live and local, but we're going to be actually 64 hours fully live. It started already a little while ago. It's going to be all the way through December 14th at 9 p.m. You can listen to it anytime, of course, on your airwaves, but you can also listen to it at WRLR.fm. The cool thing about it, the reason why we're doing this, is because WRLR is a volunteer station. It is a community-run station, and it also, too, needs your help to stick around. And so during our Christmas Radiothon, what we'd like you to do is, if you got a couple of extra bucks in your Christmas stocking, go ahead and go online, and you can donate that. Now, I've got a site specifically for the Tech Talk Show. If you go to bit.ly/WRL, oh gosh, I'm going to have to look it up and make sure I'm giving you the right number. I tell you what, go to WRLR, though, and I know that you'll be all set with finding links for it there, and I'll make sure that I get you the right link. $25 or more, you automatically get a free t-shirt. We will send that out to you. $50, and you're in line for a WRL, any amount, and any amount helps. It really does. Dave, are you back?
That's right, any amount helps.
Hey, there he is. Oh, and this looks clear and clean. I'm seeing good internet connectivity here now. So for whatever reason, I think we're doing a little bit better.
Yeah, for a change, the problem's not on my end. I'm getting a little bit of echo, but that's okay. That's right. Any amount helps, and if you give us some money, then we're going to get a better internet connection, and we won't have all these problems.
There you go. That's it. Exactly. And, you know, and the minimum for the CrowdRise, so the online at bit.ly/WRLR fundraiser, the minimum there on CrowdRise is $10. If you don't have an inclination to give $10 or you can't for whatever reason and you want to provide a different amount or a lesser amount, checks are fine. Just send them right in. Shoot them in. We're good with that. You find the address on. I'm not going to give that over there. You find the address on WRLR.FM. So that's a cool thing. Did you know, Dave, at $25, you get a WRLR t-shirt?
Oh, no. I've donated to the station from time to time. For $25, I think I'm in for a WRLR t-shirt.
Which version of the t-shirt are we talking about? You get a baseball cap. You know, that's a good question. The $25 for the t-shirt, I don't know which version it is. People that are looking at the stream online right now can see I've got a WRLR FM t-shirt on, but it's the blue. It's the dark blue one. I think the ones they're talking about are the white ones with the logo on display. On your back, very big and prominent, and it's a good looking shirt, and it's a quality t-shirt too. I will say the one that I've got on right now, I know, is high quality. It's a very thick material. Also, the white ones too. They're not the cheap thin ones that you try to stretch that kink out of your neck, and you wind up tearing the tearing the seams. You know, which is kind of nice. Sometimes you do that, and you're like, hey, I must have been working out. I feel like the Hulk.
I've worn my WRLR t-shirt around more than one, actually, around the world, and always get great comments on it. And and sometimes I get free drinks when I'm wearing it, but I'm usually in an all-inclusive resort when that happens.
They're so happy that you decided to put a shirt on.
Yeah.
It didn't matter there was a WRLR shirt. They're just, hey, free drinks for that guy. Thank goodness.
Yeah, past a certain age, that's definitely the case. They're like, yeah, here's some money, put a shirt on.
Oh, man. You know, I also have been proud to wear my WRLR shirt. I've also got a Tech Talk hat that I wear around as well. And occasionally get comments. I don't know if I mentioned to you, but in honor of our good friend Dave Sparky Saganaki up there in Canada, in his new life in Canada, I have a little Canadian pin that I put on my Tech Talk hat when I wear that around.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's very cool. Yeah.
Well, anyways, this is way off the topic of tech stuff. I'm going to bring Jay on here in just a couple minutes, too. But I saw you posting some pretty good and interesting articles. I know one of the ones that I just saw you post and some other good friends of the show, including our good friend Barb, has posted that if you're still using Windows 7, you got to be careful with some of those updates that Microsoft is putting out.
That's right. Well, it actually happened to me midweek. Tuesday or Wednesday, Microsoft typically rolls out their updates, and usually that's it for the week, and then you're done. But then I noticed on Thursday they took my update back. Apparently, on Windows 7, I have a Windows 8 computer, but I typically use my Windows 7 computer more, and I actually use it for presentations on Thursday. So when I was getting a reboot notice on Thursday morning, and I was busy working, trying to get some work done, it caused a bit of a panic. But what it does is it breaks certain programs, definitely some video drivers. So you might want to check. You can find out about it. I don't have the number handy, the number of the update handy, but some research. What the number is, and you can get it off your computer if Microsoft hasn't done it.
It's KB3004394, and it just came out on December 10th. So that's right. And, yeah, it specifically does break your graphics driver updates, specifically AMD's new Catalyst Omega drivers will probably not work if you have that installed. And it can keep newer Windows updates from going. So if you do have that, and take a look for that KB3004394, it's real easy to uninstall. You can go into your control panel, Programs and Features, View, Install, Updates, and then when you see that one, just just right-click on it and uninstall it, and then you'll be back to normal and fine. This is not, you know, this is not a new thing. It's not an uncommon thing to actually to have happen. believe it or not, I was just working on a Windows Vista machine. My mom had come into town, and and one of the first things I do whenever I touch anybody's machine, of course, is let's make sure that we're up to date on all of these updates, security changes, and things like this. Ran through those, put on the new Vista Windows updates or the whatever the newest ones were that had been missed, and rebooted, and the machine would not start. It would not go past the login screen. And, you know, sure enough, so what I did is I geared it back.
You broke your mother's computer.
Well, I fixed it, though, too. I fixed it. It took the time. Because being, of course, the extremely clever and well-prepared tech guy that I am, I, of course, always make a full backup before I do any massive changes or major updates and so on. So I was able to just roll her back to immediately before having installed the Windows updates, and voila, she worked like a charm after that. And in fact, I did a whole bunch of other things to it, cleaned it up, removed all of the browser helper objects and malware and viruses that our parents always wind up somehow getting installed on, and now it works beautifully. She said it's good for another 10 years because this laptop she's got is about 10 years old. So
Vista, huh? You let her stay with Vista. That's well, and when Microsoft's going to give up support on that, and you know, probably not too long, right?
Yeah, no, it's true. You know, it's funny though, is when that did happen, where it kind of blew up and it wouldn't start again. And remember, this is my mother now, too. So this is not someone who is necessarily, you know, hip and up on all the newest things. Mom, no offense, she may be listening. but to her credit, you know, she was actually not averse to the idea. I showed her. I said, if I can't get Windows going again, let me show you what I've been using on my laptop, which is it's one of the flavors of Linux. Right, exactly. Yeah. I showed her and said, you know, that'd be fine. If you can get that going for me, I'll figure it out. That'll work. So, you know, there are options. You do not have to follow the Microsoft upgrade path. You can just take a complete, you know, 90-degree turn off of that and do something different if you want to.
Boy, Michael, you are frugal. You know, your mother. You're gonna you install Linux on your mom's computer with that steep learning curve, rather than give her Windows 7 or something.
There's no learning curve anymore. Honestly, if what you're doing, because this is the thing. So I 5 years ago, no way would I have even dreamt of doing this. Today, not only if you look at like Linux Mint, Cinnamon, you know, some of these variations of Linux that are specifically designed to look a lot like Windows. First off, you look at it and you know what? You're really not too far out of your depth with most of the things. You know, installing new programs and applications are going to give you a little bit of a headache. But other than that, you're not too far out of depth. But the other thing that's changed, though, not just have the operating systems changed, the way that we use our computers today has changed dramatically. And my mother, with her laptop, 90% of everything she does, if not more, is all on the web. So as long as she can get into a browser window and see what she's looking at on the internet, she's happy as a clam. You know, it's just fine. You know, we're doing the same thing here in at WRLR. We're switching everybody over from the traditional installed versions of Microsoft Office and going all the way over to Office 365. So
very cool.
Yeah, you know, all you need now, that's all you need nowadays, just a browser.
Well, I take it back then. You're a good son. You're not a cheap a cheap so and so. Yeah.
Well, hey, now don't you know, don't you don't want to go too far down that path. Yeah. Oh, but no, I am happy about you know, being able to help her out and make those kind of things happen for her. But and I didn't have to do it anyways. We got Vista working again. Now, have you tried the newest version of Windows, Windows 10? Have you had a chance to kind of check
that
out?
No, I haven't. I have not jumped in.
No,
I have not. Have you?
I have not. I've toyed with the idea on it, but have not. Oh, hey, you know what? This is a perfect segue, though. So neither of us have anything to say about Windows 10, so there's no reason even talking about that anymore.
Well, we can pretend like we saw
it. Yeah,
I read some stuff about it about 3-4 weeks ago.
Exactly. But no, I've got something more relevant. I've got something much more relevant. We're talking about old, out-of-date computer software, operating systems, and all this, and people being too frugal to switch off of it. Oh, my goodness. And we were talking about flying earlier. Did you hear about the UK? All the chaos. Southern England, everything was down. No flights were moving. Why? Not because too many planes in the air. No, it's because the software that they use to control their flights has not been changed from when it was first created sometime in 1964 or so.
Well, it worked for a long time, 50 years. Sounds like you. That's a place you could have got a job as IT director.
Hey, yeah, I'm stuck in the 60s. That's my cup of tea right there. No English pun intended.
But you don't want to spend any money, and you're a proponent of it's not broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, exactly. No, I agree. I just, there are some things, and there are times when spending money is the cheapest option. And as counterintuitive as that may seem, this is one of those times when spending money is your cheapest option. Upgrading from something that was used in the 60s. They said they actually knew that it needed to be replaced as long ago as a decade or so, which is still shocking to me that you'd be using 35-year-old technology, but we're unwilling to spend the money to do it.
I wonder if that was a free program, though. You think that was one of those yearly license renewal guys, or if it was outright free? I wonder.
Open source. If it was from the 1960s, my guess that they actually it's bespoke. They programmed it themselves and probably has all of those similar issues. Now, there's a guy with abbreviated as NAS, N-A-S system. The NAS system was written back in the 60s. It was written in a now defunct language called Jovial, which is great. I love that word, too. So that means that every time that they hired new personnel to maintain the code or even just to keep the systems running, they had to train them. So they have people being trained to program in Jovial.
But that's the funny thing about computer programming, though. We have these mass movements from with operating systems and apps and programs and all those sorts of things. But sometimes a really nice piece of code is written that does a job, and people don't want to mess with it. It's like, what do you replace it with? I'm kind of charmed by that myself, that somebody did something so well that they couldn't figure out a good or efficient way to replace it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're a very positive spirit, Dave. The assumption that the reason why it wasn't changed is because it was so elegantly programmed.
Yeah. That's it, wasn't it? No.
I don't know. I honestly don't. Now, I know that they've had issues with it in the past. Like I said, they knew over a decade ago that it had to go. That it just wasn't going to scale up to the number of flights and systems that it was expected to support. Maybe you're right. I do remember my internal pain whenever one of the applications that I had developed was superseded by a professional type application. When I was first getting my start managing help desks, and I wrote and designed my own data system and forms and things like this. It connected with the Exchange system for Microsoft and Outlook, and all this, all interconnected. I was very proud of this create a help desk tracking system that would alert people and do everything that it needed to do. I was proud of it, even with the issues and problems that it had. And as I said, a little unhappy when I had to trade that in for something better. But it does happen. It does happen, and it was the best thing to do. Speaking of the best thing to do, I think the best thing we can do right now is bring our good friend Jay Garman on to see if he's.
And speaking of old and elegant, did you hear where the there was an auction for an Apple I computer?
No, I did not. Hey,
Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Steve.
Jay.
Hey, how long have we been
right
talking to
me.
Jay? And
Jay, welcome.
How we doing, guys?
Not too bad. Not too bad. We were just saying we're better off than the UK, at least as far as getting to where we want to be this weekend. All their flights shut down because of that application designed in the 60s. So I'm curious to hear your take, Jay. Just as this is it. Dave's hypothesis of why the UK still relies upon this software and code designed in the defunct programming language called Jovial since the 1960s is that it was so elegantly designed, programmed, and implemented that there just was no need to to upgrade.
Well, it obviously worked this long.
I was a little more pessimistic in my view. Or cynical, anyways. What's your take? Why would the UK hold on to applications from the 60s?
You're an IT guy who has worked in the school system, and you're asking me why people who run legacy systems are reluctant to give up legacy systems? Is that really your question?
He's just enlisting
exactly.
Your help in repudiating my opinion.
Well, first exactly. off, as someone who has friends in government, there's never one dumb reason things stay around. There's always multiple dumb reasons. Because if there's just one dumb reason, eventually it gets fixed.
Yeah.
There's got to be six or seven contributing breeds of stupid that keep stupid around for a long time.
Well,
I'm certain that there is a notion of, we have experts in this language on payroll. Why would we go and acquire new people to run a new system? What's the benefit of the change? Which is translated into, all the people that would make the decision about changing would have to be replaced with the change.
Exactly.
So that's not going to happen. Also, what's the net cost benefit? I mean, this is an honest truth. What is how bad does a computing system have to get before the inefficiencies of its current function produce an ROI that justifies replacing it? I mean, as a guy who worked for a long time writing articles on how to maintain Windows NT, like well into the mid-2000s.
I liked NT. That was a good operating system.
Absolutely.
Well, here's the thing. If it's not going to get on the internet, if all it's going to do is, for example, run a manufacturing system, why change?
Yeah.
There is a native bit rot. I mean, we don't want to talk about this. Hard drives do just natively decay.
Mm-hmm.
They do just lose bits over time. It is electricity and magnetism, and at some point, even digital systems are based in something analog and mechanical. They will eventually just bit rot and stop working. And at some point, you just can't get your hands on another copy of Windows NT. They just die.
What I love the most about these stories, like coming from the UK, is that not only do you have this, you're absolutely right. You do have to look at that ROI, but eventually, what happens is there's structure built in place specifically to continue the use of something that should have been replaced, and so dismantling that entire structure. So in this case, you've got – not only do you have these, quote-unquote, experts in Jovial, which doesn't exist anymore, but as new
– I've never heard of Jovial.
No, I never have either. But as these new people are hired, every new person then has to be trained in order to become an expert at Jovial, which, of course, has absolutely no cachet anywhere else. And so after 15, 20 years of working there – you're like, oh, no, we can't get rid of we can't get rid of this because then I'd be out of a job. And I've learned nothing else over the last 20 years. I'm going to instead train these new kids in to do exactly the same thing to them that has happened to me. And, oh, man, it just it's just brutal. The vicious cycle. The vicious cycle.
How bad could it have been? What other piece of programming has a shelf life of 50 years?
Oh, I can fire up a whole bunch of old DOS programs because Windows is backwards compatible down like the DOS 1.1, I think. If I wanted to run it in the shell, I could do it. Now, I'd have to find a Windows machine with a floppy drive somewhere to do it because they're all on 1.25, you know, 3.25 disks, but 3.5-inch disks, 1.44 megabytes. Like, I'd have to load like 6 of them to get some of my old, you know, DOS programs running. But I could do it.
Well,
it'll work.
Actually,
I'll give Windows credit for that. They've done their best to preserve backwards compatibility.
And speaking of that, I mean, this is coincidental, but literally maybe 2 weeks ago, I actually scripted a DOS batch command program because it was the simplest and easiest way to do it. I just needed to, every day at 5 o'clock, I need to transfer some files from one folder to another. And so I put it in Windows Scheduler, but I created the script as a DOS batch command exactly the same way I would have done it 30 years ago. You know, zero difference from when I had worked on a DOS, machine with no Windows at all on it. Exactly the same. I love batch. I just love the batch command language. It's just, it's great. You can do amazing things in it that people don't even realize.
Oh, I saved my bacon with a batch file from the time I was a freshman in high school until I was probably a junior in college. Sophomore in college. Because I had a batch file that ran on boot that took every boot and shutdown. Every time I booted or shut down my Windows machine, it copied everything from the Microsoft Word documents folder to my 3.5-inch drive floppy I just left in there. And I also wrote the batch command to ignore the floppy drive on boot, so it wouldn't try to boot off the floppy drive because there was always a disk in there. I basically wrote the world's most janky backup system in the world.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of the DOS batch line stuff is that it's janky, but you can figure it out. You don't have to be a master-level programmer to do something simple. It's fast, and it's so fast. You know, and if you're using DOS, you were only a step or two away from assembly. You know, I mean, it was really pretty low-level stuff, so it would just go, and it would just run, and nothing would break it. You know, there's so little going on. You can't really break it. So
that's not true. You can write infinite non-breaking loops in batch if you're not careful.
Well,
I executed this batch file, and now my computer is just going to keep going until it runs out of memory space and then force reboot because I've written a stupid batch file.
I forgot about that. That is true. That is true. Yeah, you can. It's one of my most cherished computer texts that I have is and it's incredibly thick, so this gives you an idea of how much functionality there is with the batch command system that you can use. It's from PC Mag. It's DOS batch programming, and it's got to be like 1,000 pages, and you could not get that away from me. You will not take that. That's never going in a garage sale. I'm never giving it away. If the house burns down, that's probably one of the few things that I would run back in to grab, you know, after the kids.
The kids can run. Books don't have legs.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. Books are much more flammable, too. So.
Well, you know, it's funny we talk about these legacy systems and that whole structure you talked about being in place. If you have a good CIO, and CIOs are really getting wise to this, I think, is that you have to recognize the cost of that structure and maintaining it. Like, my hiring and training costs for running obscure legacy languages are extremely high. And, you know, if you're a 50-person manufacturing operation, okay, you're going to train one person every 2 years. That's still probably cheaper than, going out and replacing your entire technical infrastructure, or at least bringing in a software consultant to go rewrite everything in a more modern language or a more modern application, especially since you'll have to do that every few years anyway. But if you're like a city or the entire United Kingdom airline industry, you're going to hire people all the time and have to train them all the time. And if you're not recognizing the cost, the human resources cost of your technology decisions, then you're not doing a good job as a CIO. Mm-hmm. And you could make, a much more cogent case. I mean, this is why Microsoft.NET, which is the least sexy language in the world, it still runs a whole lot of frontline industrial systems, because it is a well-supported language that when you, as a CIO, select it, you know you can go out and hire .NET programmers. Mm-hmm. And if you hire bad ones, you can fire them and replace them, because there are .NET programmers.
Well,
because Microsoft is making an investment and making sure there are .NET programmers.
And you hit on a really, you know, and you mentioned earlier, you know, I did work for a long time in IT and education. And one of the frustrating situations that arises there, and in every government institution, I believe this is true to some degree, has to do with the way that monies are allocated and the way that budget resources are assigned. And what happens is, it's much, much easier in some cases to get money for consultants or for people than it is to get money for systems. And it's also too much easier, on the flip side, to get money for systems and to get money for new technologies, because you can get grants and things like this, than it is to get money for the training and personnel that would then support those new technologies. And so you wind up in this kind of rotating cycle of trying to figure out, okay, if we swap out this technology for stuff that we know is better, is actually going to save us money as an institution, will I actually be able to do anything with it? Because I don't have a budget, a line number right now to let me hire someone who could actually support it beyond the next 6 months. And that's why you wind up, you see often with governmental institutions, rather than hiring expert staff, many times what they'll do is actually budget dollars for consultants, which is, a mixed bag. It can be a good thing, but it's also, too, it's just because of the expediency of being able to find money for consulting services much, much, much easier than it is to find money to actually hire somebody and add them to the payroll. And the unfortunate thing with the consultants, one of the bad sides of that is you've got no guarantee those people are going to be around, and you've also got no guarantee that you're going to have money to keep them around the following year or the year after. And so all of that brain trust and corporate knowledge walks out the door as well, very frequently.
Well, that's the whole point of consultants, is that they're a one-time budget allocation. You know, in this year's budget, you have a consultant. When I hire someone, I'm making an open-ended commitment. And if I have to get rid of them, there's a whole legal and financial procedure of severing them, which is not cheap.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you know,
yeah.
A consultant is a purchase. An employee is an investment.
Oh, that's exactly it. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And sometimes you can't do what you need to do by hiring people. You literally have to you bring in consultants and outside work. But it is frustrating on the other end. As I could tell you story after story of going into schools, going into districts, and seeing, you know, smart boards, which are wonderful pieces of educational technology. They're just beautiful if they're used properly, integrated into the curriculum. But, of course, money was there to buy the technology, but no money was allocated for professional development, integrating it into the curriculum, supporting it. So it sits on the corner, and it's basically a marker whiteboard that you could have, spent $20 for at Home Depot, and you would have been just as well off. You know, it's great for hanging kids' paintings, and that's about it. Oh man! But anyway, we're way off topic here. I think although I'm going to bring it around since we're talking on education, I found this really fascinating. Integrating technology into the classroom is that Google now with their Chromebook has actually bested the iPad as far as integration into school districts go. And so it's a very close number, but according to the Financial Times, recently the Google shipped 715,000 or so of their Chromebooks, the low-cost laptops, into U.S. schools in the third quarter, and that's compared with 702,000 iPads. So, and that it, what's even more striking is that these Chromebooks went from zero to a quarter of the educational market in only 2 years. They've only been around for 2 years, and now they make up fully a quarter of the educational market investment in one-to-one programs and technology.
That's right, amazing growth.
As I've always argued, is that tablets, iPad being the poster boy for them, are consumption devices, and laptops are creation devices. Mm-hmm. And when you are in school, part of your remit is to demonstrate knowledge and create things. And therefore, I think laptops are going to get a resurgence in the classroom. We had the great wave of introduction of iPads. But if we're going to start allocating students with technology as required, the laptop is going to make a comeback. Mm-hmm. It really is. It never left college. I have never believed that tablets even remotely supplanted anything at the collegiate level because, you know, for everyone sort of expects I have to write papers in college. Like, everyone gets that. Mm-hmm. People forget you should write a lot in high school, middle, and elementary school, too. So I really think that the laptop's going to make a comeback. And also, thanks to Chromebooks, I mean, laptops are price competitive or, compared to an iPad, better priced. You know, you can get a Chromebook cheaper than you can get a frontline iPad. You can get tablets cheaper than laptops on the whole, but you can certainly get Chromebooks cheaper than iPads.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's two other things above and beyond that. You're absolutely right with those. I think there's two other things that are really pushing this motion hard right now. And one is the adoption across the country of the new assessment standards that we have, including PARC. And the PARC assessments require that you're doing it on a computer and, of course, that you have a keyboard in order that you can respond to the test. PARC is like an online testing and evaluation, trying to assess kids, like the MAP tests and all the other ones. But it's a new one, and it's required, and it's going to be much more integrated. So you have to have a keyboard for that. So I think that's one of the big things pushing this. The other one, too, is that Apple has been very slow to move forward aggressively with a really functional institutional level mobile device management solution and document sharing solution that is really well suited to the educational environment, whereas Google Apps for Education has been entrenched for some time now, and even Microsoft has really made some great strides forward with their Office 365 services and pulling that into the school districts. It's really tough to effectively use Apple's integrated mobile device management tools in order to have a really effective one-to-one program in a school district, not just to get the software out to people, but also to manage and maintain the actions and activity that they take. Apple really leaves it up to the device and the apps themselves to help with that, whereas Google, interestingly, has kind of gone the other direction and said, we're going to create the cloud infrastructure that you need in order to make all of this seamless. And they've done a good job of it. I mean, not that there's no problems and issues there, too, but they've done a really good job of it. So those are the two things that I keep seeing come up that I shake my head every time I see a school district, especially, as you're saying, you know, middle school level or higher, investing heavily in one-to-one programs specifically focused around the iPad. I just don't see that being viable long-term or as deeply functional as it needs to be.
Well, as a father of a child in elementary school, the vibe I've always gotten, we've not had any iPad programs here locally of any scale, is it's very easy. Oh, iPad is what you read on. That's how textbooks are going to change. We have to buy iPads to replace textbooks. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the thought process there. But you're going to put the iPad down, then you're going to have the kids do all their homework still with pencil and paper. Like, that's sort of the mindset, is we're just flipping the books out but we're not really understanding this as a computing device.
Yep.
It's just, oh, I can give you an iPad and I just put virtual books on there and we'll save money on textbooks or whatnot, that sort of thing. They're not really thinking of it as a true, robust educational device. They're just thinking of it as a textbook replacement. It's a super Kindle.
Yeah. Well, and actually, it's interesting you bring up the Kindle because so I've had a few discussions recently with people at Amazon, and I believe, and I don't have inside knowledge here at all, but from what I'm seeing and what I'm reading and the people I'm talking to, I believe Amazon is poised in 2015 to really attack the education market again in a way that they haven't in the past. And specifically because of the amount of development that's going in to their own mobile device management tools. It's called WhisperCast. If you just use it at home, Kindle, you've got a Kindle at home, you probably do not know what WhisperCast is. But it's specifically designed to allow you to push out information and books and documents and so on to a large number of Kindle devices, or at least a Kindle application, and also too to receive and collect information about how those documents are being used. You know, pages per minute, words per minute, reading. You know, that type of thing. Amazon has never been really heavily focused on devices, but this might be something that would change a bit for them if they could produce for education a really well-designed WhisperCast solution, and then you have putting in kids' hands paper whites or something similar for less than $75 a piece. Now you add that to a Chromebook for your document creation. It seems it would just be a really natural and very easy to justify ROI.
Well, but the other part of that with WhisperCast, which I assume is an outgrowth of WhisperSync, which if folks haven't heard of that, is a really cool thing Amazon does with Audible.com, which is if you're listening to an audiobook and you also have the ebook of the same title, it will know where you stopped listening, and when you open the text version, it will take you to the exact point you stopped listening.
Oh, I didn't know
that.
It's
a good
sense of where you're consuming. So I want to consume the new, I don't know, Janet Ivanovich book or whatever. And I'm going to listen to it when I'm on the train, but I'm going to read it when I'm at home or on my lunch break. And I can switch between the two formats and keep my place. That's the whole point of WhisperSync. And I think that the whole Whisper platform, from what little I've read about it, and is sort of Amazon's brand of I monitor consumption of IP regardless of format.
That is very, very cool. I did not know it had that functionality. I know there's a lot of stuff with the Amazon, with the Kindle app, that people don't realize. You know, where you can get my favorite thing to show off to people if they are using their Kindle or using a Kindle app that they don't know most of the time is the X-ray button. And it's not every single book, but a lot of the books out there have been. I don't know exactly the process they go through to do this, but the books are analyzed. So if you're on a page and you click this X-ray button, which you'll see in the upper right-hand corner, it will bring up a one-line description of every character that's referenced on the page, definitions of key terms, and also some basic plot structure or other information that may be reasonable or valuable for you to look at, and also, too, what people are highlighting or sharing out of the book themselves. So there's just a tremendous amount of functionality that we can add to our reading experience that may not be immediately apparent. And yeah, I'd like to see Amazon really push that into the education market. They tried in the past and failed. iPad seems to, and Apple seems to be slipping. Google's moving in. There's a lot of opportunity. A lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, speaking of slipping, time is slipping away.
Oh, time keeps on slipping.
Good old Dave, keeping us on track.
I want to listen to you guys for hours, but, you know, the station has other things going on.
Other people may not. Before we get to Geek Trivia response from the Apollo 17 question last week, I want to make another quick shout out here is that this is – The Radiothon. This is the time of our Radiothon. We don't normally, you know, go aggressively asking for cash and all that, but today we are. if you go to bit.ly/WRLR fundraiser, you'll get in there. That's our CrowdRise page. It's very easy. Throw some money into that bucket that supports. It's completely tax deductible, too. Do not forget that. We're getting close to the end of the year. This is the time to start making sure that all of those ill-gotten gains you have are not taxed more than you want them to be. We make a good tax shelter for that. Don't listen to any of my financial advice. But but the other thing I want to mention to you as well, we've got anyone that donates $25 or more, free WRLR t-shirt. $50, you get a baseball hat, and $150 or more, and you get to be a radio star. Free 1 hour broadcast. You play your own music and all of your pre-recorded messages. We also have a food drive going on right now. You can drop off donations at the station, 629 Pontiac Court, right next to the Village Hall, any day between noon and 5 p.m. So all sorts of good stuff going on for that. And, Jay, so tell us, there were additional vertebrates that the astronauts took with them on a trip to the moon, I hear.
Yeah, so beyond, you know, microbes and viruses and whatnot, there were living things intentionally taken on the last Apollo mission as part of what was known as the BioCore, the Biological Cosmic Ray Experiment, which is a very polite way of saying we took 5 pocket mice with radiation meters surgically implanted in their scalps to the moon to see if cosmic rays would kill them. And the answer is not immediately. 4 of the 5 pocket mice actually made it back from the moon, and the one that died was almost certainly died from flight stress, not from cosmic rays. However, there was pretty fair evidence that they suffered liver damage from cosmic ray exposure while they were on the moon. So that's going to be an issue if we ever build a base there. To back up a little bit, the reason they really wanted to try this experiment, among other reasons, just in general science, is that ever since Mercury, but especially in the earlier Apollo flights, the astronauts would complain to quote-unquote fireflies or streaks, which is even when they closed their eyes, they could see yellowish streaks of light, like even through the walls of the spacecraft, and they thought that might be high-energy particles impacting their retinas through the spacecraft. You're basically cosmic rays hitting you and firing off the receptors. So they're like, we need to figure out exactly what happens to living things. And we know mice really well, and they're like canaries in coal mines. They really respond to biological stimulus much faster than big, massive people in spacesuits. So let's throw some of those on the moon and see what happens.
Yeah, you know, it's there's a funny story, though, too. I guess not funny, really. In order to kind of test that idea out, there were scientists, or a scientist anyways, who actually stuck his head inside of a particle accelerator. His name was Bogorsky, and he was in Pradvino. And he didn't do it intentionally. He was checking a piece of equipment that had malfunctioned, but it fired off, and that's what he saw as well, as he saw those streaks and things. And it also,
I remember him. Didn't he then go on to fight the Flash and Superman in Justice League number 27?
Yes, yes. When the once the superpowers became apparent. No, unfortunately, he did, of course, pass away fairly quickly, and in fact, the beam had burned through his skin, his skull, and the brain tissue, and you know, that kind of thing. I take it back. I take it back. He did not die right away. I'm just looking it up right now. I did a little Google to check myself, and he actually survived for quite a long time. In fact, I don't have a time of death on him. He may still be alive. He.
You know what? I can just hear the donations rolling in right now.
Yeah, they're this is the kind of radio that people want to pay for.
A death certificate is because he's in the Phantom Zone with General Zod, okay?
Oh, God.
But we all know that he's really Kang. So, because everybody ultimately is Kang. So on that note, shouts out to Customer Jones, who actually, even though I hadn't released the podcast, bugged me and said, "What's the trivia? I need to figure this out." She got it. She nailed it. She's the only one that even had a chance at it because she bugged me. What should she at least be thinking about for next week?
Well, on the subject of nuclear reactors, we're actually approaching the 64th anniversary of the world's first nuclear reactor to actually produce usable electricity. On December 20th, 1951, Experimental Breeder Reactor 1 went online in Arco, Idaho, because in the 50s we considered Idaho expendable for nuclear experiments. There were a number of reactors in the greater Boise area, so if anything went wrong, all we'd have is mutant potatoes. So the question is, when this thing went online in 1951, they wanted its primary purpose was not actually to generate electricity. It had a number of other experimental purposes, but it was the first one to generate usable electricity. So how much power did the world's first electrical generating nuclear reactor actually generate, and how did they prove it?
Hmm. Oh, wow. Okay, very cool. Very cool. It'll probably be like like our first bandwidth question we had a few weeks ago. It'll probably be shockingly low, I'm guessing, but perhaps not. No, that is a great question. It is time for Rob Shot First to start hopping in here. So I'm gonna cut us off, guys. Thank you so much for joining in today.
Thank you. I just wanted to say a quick hello to Lou in Australia. We haven't said hello to him for a while, and his lovely lady.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a great point from down under. Do they even know it's Christmas there?
No.
Sorry, never mind. I won't get on that topic. Yes, shouts out Lou and Darlene is his lovely lady.
Yes.
Always happy to have them as listeners, and we truly are live and worldwide, and love being on every week. Jay and Dave. I'm going to say goodbye and let Rob come in and take over the studio.
All
next
right,
time.
Have a good weekend, fellas.
Yep, you too. You too. Great.
Take
thanks,
care,
guys.
Jay.
Have a great week.
Great week.
Dave Snocky, Jay Geek Trivia Garmin. Go to jgarmin.net. You can get more about that. I wasn't kidding. Rob, Rigel, Rob Shot First. He's right here. He's ready to go. He's setting himself up right now. I'm going to leave you with one quick Christmassy type of song, but of course it's a very Tech Talk Christmas, so I'm going to play you a very Voldemort Christmas. If you're a Harry Potter fan, you may know what this is referring to. If not, it still is a great rockin' tune, so enjoy it. And don't go away, because I'm not kidding. Rob is right here and ready to go, too. Great show. Thanks for listening, everybody, to Tech Talk on WRLR LPFM 98.3 in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Have a great week. And this is A Very Voldemort Christmas by Draco.
This here is a story that goes back for generations. My daddy told me when I was little, and his daddy told him when he was little, and well, great-granddad Malfoy told granddad Malfoy when he was little, and well, heck, this Christmas story goes back as far as there have been Death Eaters themselves. It's the story about the time that
Voldemort stayed up real late so he could visit with Santa Claus. He asked him for a puppy, 'cause Voldemort loves those little paws.
You see, one Christmas Eve a long time ago, little orphan Voldemort was in his orphan hole down at the orphanage. You see, Voldemort was an orphan, a poor and lonely orphan. He didn't even have enough money to cobble two sticks together. And he was lonely. Boy, was he lonely. Nobody loved little old orphan Voldemort, because no one loves an orphan. The thing he wanted more than anything else was just a friend. A friend that wouldn't mind being kicked and punched and spelled on, because that's just the way that little orphan Voldemort played. He didn't know any better. And what better friend for Little Orphan Voldemort than a puppy? The problem was, there was only one way that Little Orphan Voldemort could get his puppy, and that was through Santa Claus. So this one particular Christmas Eve, Voldemort stayed up really, really late, way past his bedtime, so he could meet Santa Claus. He was passing the time by painting rainbows on the backs of ants and letting them loose in his ant farm. Voldemort had conditioned his ant farm to be violently intolerant towards gay ants. While he was watching the fun, there arose such a clatter, and then there appeared Santa Claus.
Hey, it's me, Santa Claus. What's the matter, you being up so late, huh?
Said Santa Claus.
Hello there, Santa Claus. My name's Tom Whittle, but my friends call me Voldemort. I really want a puppy. Can I have a puppy for Christmas? Pretty please?
Said Voldemort.
Hey, what kind of little fool do you think I am, Edda? You's a very, very bad boy. You no get a puppy,
said Santa Claus.
Oh, shucks, mister. But please?
Said Voldemort.
No,
said Santa Claus.
But please?
Said Voldemort.
No,
said Santa Claus.
But I want to tell you something,
said Voldemort.
What's the matter?
Said Santa Claus.
Imperio.
Just then, Little Orphan Voldemort's eyes turned a deep scarlet red, and Little Tom Riddle entered the mind of Santa Claus.
This is your Dark Lord Voldemort. Put the puppy in the stocking if you wish not to be harmed. If you fail to put the puppy in the stocking, you will be harmed. If you put the puppy in the stocking, you will not be harmed.
And with a glazed look in his eye, Santa Claus reached into his bag of puppies, grabbed one and put it in Voldemort's stocking.
Thank you, so nice,
said Santa Claus.
Thanks, Mr. Santa Claus. Oh my goodness, my very own puppy.
And then, with a poof, Santa Claus disappeared in a cloud of Christmas cheer.
And Little Orphan Voldemort was left with his puppy, who he loved and tortured for the rest of his days. And that was the story of how
Voldemort stayed up real late so he could visit with Santa Claus. He asked him for a puppy, 'cause Voldy just loved those little paws.